Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
And it's just the two of us again. Lyle is still lost in the wilds of Canada.
Oh, I was going to say he still hasn't gotten back in our good graces to get on the show again.
Ah, yeah, that too. That's why we exiled him to Canada.
Right.
Yes.
last weekend I got a chance to play a game that I had heard about and been interested in for a while, but obviously hadn't gotten a chance to play, called Splendor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Euro game where the theme, you know, like most Euro games, is very much devoid from the mechanics of the game.
But, it's a board game.
It's a card game, but you need a surface to play it because you lay out a lot of cards.
Okay.
So, yeah, a board game. Basically, the theme is you are kind of gem merchants, and you're collecting or buying gem mines, and eventually nobles will come and visit your gem mines if you have enough of them.
Mm-hmm.
But the theme is very much devoid from the mechanics. It's a card drafting game.
Yeah.
And you're drafting an engine, essentially. So there are five different colors of gems, like white, blue, green, red, and brown.
Mm-hmm.
Each card produces a resource every turn,
mm-hmm.
and certain cards also give you a score. So to start the game, you kind of draft a card from the ones that are available,
mm-hmm.
and you have to pay its cost with other gems. At the beginning of each of your turns, all your mines produce a gem. So the lower ranking cards may produce one blue gem,
mm-hmm.
but to purchase that card, you may have to essentially spend a white, a red, and a green gem to purchase that card. So it's kind of tricky because you have to be looking ahead to figure out, okay, how am I going to purchase the higher tier cards, which are worth more points?
Mm-hmm.
And you just kind of have to like plan, okay, like I can produce so many of these colored gems this turn. It's pretty cool. I played it about three times. And it's quick playing games, only about 20 minutes.
It doesn't sound too dissimilar from that other Euro game, Power Grid. Because you've got the resources and you build the power stations and they're keeping things like that. But
right. I guess there's similarities there. Power Grid has some really cool mechanics about making sure that people don't get screwed.
Right.
You know, where the person with the lowest amount of money gets to go first in certain phases and stuff like that. In Splendor, it's just everybody takes one turn.
Oh, okay.
And you just kind of go around like that. It's the other thing that attracted me to it, and I've explained it rather poorly, but hey, it's a game, and you learn it best by playing it. But anyway, it's not language-dependent. Like, there's no text on any of the cards. And once you explain the fairly simple rules, and once you take a couple turns, you know how to play.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, I've been, you know, given our situation, I've been interested in games that have no in-game language dependency.
That's pretty cool, especially for a Euro game, because it sounds like the rules are simple, but you can get some more complicated games. I love that emergent complexity.
Yeah, again, there's kind of multiple levels to the game, where at first you're just kind of building your little engine and aiming to purchase these higher cards. And then the kind of the second level of the game is looking at what other people are doing, and then trying to figure out what cards they would purchase on their turns and what cards they might be going for and try to race them.
Buying it out from under them.
Well, that's the third one. The third one is actively kind of screwing over people, because you say, okay, I know you're going to try and buy that card next time, so I'll buy it first.
Excellent.
Even though I don't necessarily need it. But
it does sound like a cool game then.
Yeah. If I can find it here, I'll get it.
Awesome.
And then we will try and find time to play it.
I look forward to it. For myself, I just got a chance to play for the first time the newest edition of Warhammer 40,000.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it just came out probably, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago, mid-early May for that. And this is now 7th edition, which it was a little bit contentious because they released it only 2 years after 6th edition came out. So
another fluff, but I've been out of the game for a while. And
mm-hmm.
I knew that the latest edition kind of came close on the heels of the previous edition, but I didn't know it had been that close.
Yeah, well, to be honest, 6th edition, they kind of rebooted the whole system. They changed it to a bit more kind of gamey versus a simulations thing way back in 3rd edition. Mm. That would have been, I don't know, early 90s, something like that.
Right.
I don't know. But 6th edition was kind of another reboot attempt where they really redid a lot of the rules and kind of changed the whole balance of the way the game played. But I think that they broke a lot of things. Hmm. There are a lot of units and armies that got really overpowered, and the balance was really heavily weighted towards what they call Death Star units, which are kind of where you put all your powerful characters together into one super unit and then just kind of go around the table cleaning things up.
Hmm. So like fantasy.
Yeah, yeah, actually, that was the thing. They made it a lot more similar to the way that fantasy worked, and I think to the detriment of the game. Hmm. And I think Games Workshop may actually agree, because they... 7th edition, a lot of people are saying that it's more similar to like a 6.5 because it's just kind of cleaning up the rules.
Hmm.
And it cleaned up a lot of rules that have been troublesome since, way back since 3rd, 4th edition. So,
right.
Yeah, it's definitely improvement. I still like the older version better, but maybe it's just because I'm an old gamer grump.
You're talking about like 2nd edition where you had like the psychic power cards? And
well, actually, you know, with 6th edition, they reintroduced the power cards.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I know why. More stuff to buy.
that's probably a big part of it. No,
yeah.
I think one of the things that I liked more about 40K versus Warhammer Fantasy is that 40K was a lot more tactical, whereas Fantasy had a lot more random elements to it, specifically in the magic phase where you'd roll a lot of dice and those would determine what powers you got and how powerful your powers are and things like that. In 40K, though, you could choose everything when you went into battle, and there wasn't that much randomality. Randomality came in, like, when you're shooting and wounding.
Right, right.
But with 6E, and now continuing into 2nd, they put a lot of more randomality into it. When you walk into a forest on the table, the forest gets its random terrain features. The leader of your army gets his randomized warlord traits. All your psychers get random psychic powers.
Hmm.
So, I think I see the reason that they're doing it is that it makes the game less tactical, so it's more open to other players. New players can still have a better chance playing as older players because there's more randomality to the game.
Right.
But as an older player, I don't like that as much.
Huh.
Yeah.
Really? And not to get into like a Dice Wars thing here, but I know you said you like D20 because you like the kind of randomality and... But I always said, no, I like to be able to kind of count on what my guy is going to be able to do, at least in a role-playing game sense. So,
yeah. Well, because for me, there's a pretty big difference between, when we're kind of making that collaborative narrative of a role-playing game versus, a tactical war game on a board.
That is true. Yeah, you do, or you can definitely win a war game, and you're supposed to aim to win. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But that's not to say that it's bad. I mean, 7th edition is better than 6th edition in many ways. And since it's kind of a new, more open system of the rules, and they are simplified quite a bit, if anybody out there is looking for a war game and you've been thinking about 40K, now is a good time to get in because it's pretty wide open and the rules
aren't
pretty new.
Don't do it.
Exactly. The caveat to it is that you will spend millions of dollars.
Yep. Don't do it.
You'll lose your house.
Yep. Yeah. Love the 40K universe. Not that I hate Games Workshop, the company, but I'm not going to buy their stuff with their annual price hike and, constant changing of the rules that eliminate entire, 75% of your army that got. So,
they totally swung it around, too. Well, how I said 6th edition was totally favored towards shooting units, and vehicles were really crap, but now it's swung the opposite way where they gave vehicles a really big bump this one around, and shooting is less than now.
Hey, those big Imperial Guard tank kits. There you go.
There you go. There you go. Something like $100 for your Land Raider tank.
Right.
Yeesh.
Yep.
But anyway,
it is more.
It is a very good game, just also very expensive.
That's why you play Paper Hammer.
It's true. That's something out there, actually. Papercraft Warhammer.
Yep.
Well, speaking of role-playing games versus tabletop war games, there is actually an aspect of role-playing games that can be fairly similar to tabletop war games, and that's kind of when you get into combat and you have the encounters. And by amazing chance, that's the topic of today's episode.
Right. Kind of started with not an argument, as most of our things usually do.
We agreed a lot this time.
Yeah. But we were talking about encounter balance, whether that's something you should aim for in a role-playing game or not. And that led to the idea of just doing an episode about building encounters.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're going to look at some of the different ways that, some of the different methods at building encounters and some of the questions that you might want to ask yourself to help you design a working and fun encounter.
Right, because that's the point, to have fun.
Yeah, true, true.
Yeah, well, I suppose some people think it's winning, but...
I suppose it doesn't depend on your game group, but...
Those people should go play a war game.
Actually. So yeah, onto that big contentious issue, balance. Should encounters be balanced?
My feeling is no.
That's much softer than I expected. Okay. I was expecting the no hammer to come out.
Well, no hammer. Well, no. My feeling is the only balance that should exist in an encounter is kind of reality. Mm-hmm. Like, for whatever setting you're playing in, does this encounter make sense? Do the components of this encounter make sense? Mm-hmm. And if so, then, in my opinion, it's balanced. I realize in some games it's easier to do that than in others. I didn't run D&D 4E, but you did, Chris. So you have experience building encounters.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like you kind of had to stick to maybe not an encounter budget, but kind of like a... There were rules or guidelines for building encounters when the party was at a certain level. And it seemed like... The encounters built that way swung pretty heavily in favor of the player characters, where I never really felt all that in danger.
Well, that was just an example of my encounters being rather unbalanced, actually.
Yeah, in our favor. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. So some games, it's more difficult to just simulate reality because the encounters are expected to be built a certain way. Again, going back to D&D 4E, like certain... monsters or bosses would be so hard just because of their incredibly high armor class or incredibly high damage. There's pretty much no chance that low-level PCs would hit them.
Right.
So in that sense, or in those cases, I understand why you have to, you know, kind of make things even. But in other games, you're just like, nope, the fiction says that this thing should be there, so it's there.
Mm.
Deal with it.
Well, actually, I suppose maybe getting into what we mean by this balance and versus reality, this is kind of two different philosophies towards making encounters. The first being that, as Wayne was describing, something should not be balanced. As Wayne described, encounters should be realistic to the fantasy of the world. For example, if a player group goes into a dragon's cavern, there's going to be a dragon in there. It doesn't matter if they're first level or not. That's what the fiction of the story is. And if they're first level, goodbye players, you know?
Right, right. I guess I should have clarified, and you're absolutely right. If a first level, or if a group of first level PCs, to use the D&D terminology, go into a dragon's lair, the dragon is going to be there, and it's going to be as powerful as a dragon needs
yes,
to be.
Yes.
It's not going to get scaled down to the level of the PCs so that they have a 50-50 or... you know, whatever percent chance. It's probably going to be a no chance because, hey, you're first level PCs.
Right. Whereas the opposite to that is where each encounter, and we're speaking primarily about fight scenes here, but all encounters work as well. Each encounter is balanced to the level of the player so that the players have a something of a chance to beat it or at least be able to hit it in the case of some systems like you were explaining before.
Right, right.
So, yeah. For me, I agree with you. 90%.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I much prefer that players kind of exist in a more immersive world to where if they're in a bad situation, then it's a bad situation regardless of what their level or powers are, if they've gotten themselves in there. But I don't want to say that that's kind of an absolutist position, because there are games, again, like 4E, that are designed to be more gamey, more like a tabletop war game than like a storytelling game. In which case, the whole system is designed around encounters being balanced, and you have, it's exactly as you said, you have a specific budget for each session and each fight, how many monsters of what level and what powers are should be there. And that's not to say that you can't make other level encounters, but that's not really how the system is written.
Right, right. Like, I think you could build realistic encounters in any system.
Mm-hmm.
just like you could build balanced encounters in any system. Mm-hmm. I just think that certain systems lend themselves easier to one way or the other.
Yeah.
Where D&D and Pathfinder, and even 13th Age a little bit with its encounter budget, I forget exactly what they call it, tend to skew a little bit more towards the game balance where, you know, PCs of a certain level should be going up against monsters of a certain level to make it a difficult or whatever challenge.
Yeah.
Where game like Dungeon World, where when you build a monster, you answer questions about the monster, such as like, you know, how tough is it? All these other questions, and just throw that monster up against the PCs if they happen to encounter it, and there is no worry about game balance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and despite that Wayne and I definitely have a preference towards the more realistic version of it, that's not to say that there's anything wrong with doing the more balanced approach. If your group enjoys doing a kind of more a fighty game aspect to it, then, you know, more power to you.
So now that we've talked about balance and kind of where
led that
you
elephant
and I,
out of the room.
Yeah. So let's look at how we would actually build an encounter or sort of the parts of an encounter, the questions we would ask ourselves when building an encounter. Because, well, I don't think that an encounter should be balanced. I do think that it should be fun because you are playing a game. You are there to have fun. And if the encounter is boring, why are you doing it?
I agree. That's good advice. Don't make boring encounters.
Yes. And hopefully this will help you do that.
Yeah. So Wayne and I put our heads together quite hard, and we came up with a list of questions that we ask ourselves when we're building up encounters to try and make them more interesting and fun. The first is, what is the purpose of the encounter? Second is, what is at stake? Third is, who is part of it? Fourth is, how to make it interesting and exciting? And lastly, how can it end?
Right.
So we'll start right with the first one. What is the purpose of the encounter?
This is going to sound bad, like I'm undercutting you, but sometimes the purpose of an encounter can just be to see what the players and player characters do. That's not always the best thing to do, and you probably shouldn't do it that often. But again, after playing Apocalypse World-style games, sometimes an encounter, I just threw encounters at you guys just to see how you would react.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, I sort of ask myself these other questions in play to kind of continue it on. But sometimes you can just start from that basic premise.
Yeah.
Not always a good idea, though.
Well, you know, there's the old random encounter tables as part of the old D&D games. And there's nothing wrong with that either. Sometimes the purpose of an encounter is just to have an encounter. You know, your players are itching for some action. They want to throw some dice. So there you go. It's to fight.
No, you're absolutely right. That's kind of a metagaming example, but sometimes the purpose of an encounter is to recapture player attention in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, you bringing up the old school random encounter table, sometimes the purpose of an encounter is to drain the characters of resources.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a tangent under that is to force them to make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And that's those are, as you said, very gamey kind of meta aspects of it. But there's also one that you can use within the game for example, to further along the plot, to build tension, to introduce clues or ideas to the players. Yeah, lots of different things.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, this is a broad question that is not difficult to answer without context, but we can only kind of provide general answers without that context. Of course, if you have your campaign, and once you have your characters and you kind of know what the basic story is that you're playing, then what's the purpose of the encounter becomes a lot easier.
Yeah, and that's really the reason that you ask yourself this question, is to try and focus yourself on why you're building this. And that really helps you figure out what kind of an encounter you should be making. If we use the earlier examples of we're just trying to introduce a little bit of fun or drain the PC's resources, you'd know that you wouldn't want it to be an extended encounter because there's no overall purpose to it. It's not going to heavily weigh on the player's conscience at all. I mean, I suppose it could turn out that way, but that's not the introduced purpose of it. Whereas if it's something that's more important to the plot, then the players are already going to have some emotion invested into it. So you can go for a longer drawn out kind of encounter, and you can probably count on their being able to keep more attention.
Right. Like, and again, it's difficult to answer this question kind of in a vacuum, but if you have proactive players, then the purpose of the encounter may have been given to you by player action.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, it kind of gets a little bit roundabout there, but in terms of, you know, the egg coming before the chicken, but no, that doesn't make any sense. Well,
the eggs do come before chickens, I believe.
Dinosaur came before the chicken, goddammit.
Yeah, but that's, again, this question is very wide open, and it's primarily there just to focus yourself on what you want to achieve with this given encounter.
But I think that's a really important question, and again, even though we're kind of only providing general examples, like, didn't mention it before, but one of the resources we used to put this episode together was an article by the Angry DM called How to Build Freaking Awesome Encounters.
Yeah.
And some of these questions were inspired by that article, and I thought he had a really good point about kind of if you don't ask yourself what the purpose of an encounter is, you run the risk of it going on too long and it becoming boring.
Yes.
The example he used in his article was building an encounter with a fight between some spiders.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, if you just throw some spiders at the players, well, you're kind of limiting yourself and the players to fighting until one side or the other is dead.
Right.
Because you didn't set up what the purpose of the encounter was. Like, if, using our examples, kind of the purpose of the encounter is to drain them of resources, well, then you, as a GM, know when you've done that and can, you know, put a logical end to the encounter, either be by the spiders run away, or you know how many spiders there should be so that the players have a bit of a fight but don't blow all their resources for, you know, the adventuring day or whatever time system you're using. But if the purpose of the encounter is for them to get something from the spiders or for them to interact with the spiders, well then, who interacts with spiders? That's a horrible example. But
fantasy spiders can talk. It's all good.
Yeah, all right, okay. Driders, how about that? Driders. Yeah. But if the purpose of the encounter is something other than wholesale slaughter of one or the other, then you know when the encounter should be over.
Yeah, that's a really good example, and that's a really good article, too. We'll link it in the show notes, and everybody should take a look at it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's angrier than our opinions, but it's very good.
Yes, well, he is the angry DM.
Yes, this is true, he is. No, actually, his articles are fantastic. I highly recommend anybody check out his website.
So, leading into the purpose of the encounter, second question is, what's at stake?
Yes.
And, yeah, this ties in very neatly, because very often the purpose of an encounter, especially combat, actually, not very often, almost always the purpose of an encounter is for the player characters to achieve something.
Yes.
And so it could be, yeah, getting across the cavern that's infested by spiders. It could be, you know, defeating the arch wizard before he completes, you know, the spell of summoning or whatever, or throw any fantasy trope you want in there. It could be, hey, getting the ring into enemy lands and to dump it into a big volcano.
Well, what a great idea.
Yeah, I know. I'm glad I thought of it. I'm sure no one else ever has, ever.
Yeah.
But
when I look at this question, I tend to think of it as what's at stake dramatically. I try to think about what the players have invested in, not only this precise moment where the encounter is happening, but where they are overall in their adventure or quest or what have you. Because they could be on some kind of a time limit, in which case this delaying action could, you know, really push them along, or they could have a lot of resources that are that they don't want to lose, be it their magical powers or money or even just hit points. Or, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a combat action. It could be a social one where you're trying to convince, you know, the king to raise his armies against the coming horde, that kind of thing. So
right.
There can be enormous amounts at stake. And this way it helps you balance just how much the players have invested and how hard or how likely they are to you know, put all their effort into it.
Right. Like, I gave bad examples, because the things I'd been saying were goals, essentially, where what you said is exactly right, Chris. There are larger things at stake in most interesting encounters, right? Mm-hmm. Again, to use the Lord of the Rings example, okay, great. If you don't get the ring into Mount Doom, darkness is going to cover the land and everything's going to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a bit extreme, but there's a lot at stake there. Or, yeah. You know, if you don't stop the were-rat infestation, then the town's going to be overrun.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you don't find a cure to that, you know, for that friend who was bitten, then he's going to develop lycanthropy and, you know, become an NPC.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I like about Dungeon World and other Powered by the Apocalypse World games, when you are designing an adventure, and I use that very loosely because you play to find out in those games.
Mm-hmm.
When you're setting up a little scenario, you're encouraged to ask yourself, what is at stake? To make a couple of stakes questions.
Mm-hmm.
And you're very explicitly told not to answer these questions. They're just supposed to be interesting things that, you know, kind of leap out at you when you're setting up an encounter or an adventure. So it could be something like, you know, will the players get the antidote to lycanthropy before their friend succumbs? Or will the town be overrun by were-rats? Or, you know, will such and such's brother be found?
That's awesome. So, it sounds like the end of an old Superman episode. Will Superman be able to defeat the Green Goblin? Wait, Spider-Man. But yeah, anyway.
Did the Superman fight Green Goblin? I don't know.
No, Spider-Man fought the Green Goblin. Will Spider-Man be able to defeat the Green Goblin?
Yeah, there you go. Again, we don't have Lyle to correct us on our comic book inaccuracies.
Exactly.
But, no, that is kind of what it sounds like. And, again, you're encouraged to find out those answers through play.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not really, I suppose you could, but you're not really supposed to steer the players or the fiction one way or the other. Just like, this is something interesting that could happen. What's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Let's find out.
And if you know your players well, if you know what is at stake for them, what they're interested in protecting or saving, then you know exactly what buttons to push and what things to threaten to give the encounter more weight or more importance.
Right, right. You know, kind of, again, we default to fantasy because that's kind of what everybody defaults to. But, you know, a combat encounter with a bunch of orcs for no reason other than they're there in the room, not very interesting. You know, a combat with a bunch of orcs because they are holding one of the character's family prisoner. Well, that's a bit more interesting.
Yeah.
There's something at exactly. stake for that character, and hopefully the player is invested. And if they're not, well, then that backstory of them having a family, just cross it off.
Exactly.
Because they lied about it.
Well, you know, an example of that would be just the recent Hobbit movie that came out. There was a huge fight between the dwarves and Smaug inside Lonely Mountain, which wasn't part of the Hobbit books. And you know what? It was boring.
Right. Right.
It was like 20 minutes of just dwarves running around and fighting a dragon, and you didn't really care.
Hmm. Was there anything at stake?
Well, I mean, yes, because the dragon is dangerous, so the dwarves' lives were at stake, and succeeding on their mission, yes, but still, bleh.
Mm. Yeah. That's too bad.
But this kind of goes back to the first question. What was the purpose of that encounter? Was to have an encounter.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, to put it into movie terms, it was to show off some CG stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if you translated that to game terms, then it would just be, what, I don't know, to show off?
Yeah, I guess. Mm.
Yeah. Example of a bad encounter.
There you go.
Don't do it.
Which Peter Jackson does a lot of. I think he's a great director, but some his movies are too long and there's too much superfluous action.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. Like, I haven't seen the second Hobbit movie, because why did they make it three movies? It's such a short book. But I saw the first Hobbit, and I thought, yeah, the fight with the goblins in, you know, the mines. I'm like, okay, this is going on way too long.
Exactly.
It's what's like the purpose here?
Game.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, actually, you mentioned just a moment ago about the characters' backstories. You know, their dwarven family being held hostage and things like that. And primarily, this goes to the PCs in the game. You know, what are their backgrounds? What are their histories? What are their wants, desires? All those different kind of things. But of course, it also applies to any NPCs or even the monsters within an encounter. You know, everyone has motivations and desires. And if you flesh those out, you can learn a lot about how they will react within the encounter and make it more lifelike and more interesting.
Right. Again, more advice that I really like is to give every NPC a life or give every monster a life.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, that makes combat or any encounter in general more interesting because the NPCs or the characters that the players are acting or interacting with have goals and motivations.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, initially I thought this question was just kind of like, okay, who are the participants? And it is in a way, because you have to figure out, okay, who's going to be around whenever you're setting up any encounter, be it, you know, combat or social.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, then digging into those characters and figuring out what they want to get out of the encounter and what their motivations are is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. The questions we presented here, they aren't in any specific order. You can move them around and shuffle them. You can mix the previous one, what's at stake, with this one about who's a part of it. If you think of, for example, the NPCs or the monsters in the encounter. For example, if you're fighting a group of orcs, well, normally you just think of the orcs, all right? You fight until they're dead. But if you flesh them out, you know, who are these orcs? What are they doing? If they're part of a raiding party, and things turn against them, then they'll most likely run away, because that's the easiest thing to do. But if, on the other hand, they're defending their territory, or even their homes, then they would most likely fight to the death. Well,
right.
Maybe not for orcs, but for some people.
Yeah, it's going to be longer before they give up.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's a very good point. And, you know, towards the beginning of the episode, I mentioned that sometimes the purpose of the encounter was just to throw an encounter in the face of both the players and the characters to see how they react, which, if you don't then ask yourself these questions as the encounter is going on, it becomes a pretty boring encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine to do that, but then once you do that, okay, yeah, figure out what this person or what this creature wants and why it's kind of up in the player character's face,
mm-hmm.
which, again, if you're playing an Apocalypse World-style game, you're doing that at the table, sweating bullets, because the player just asks you why, and then you got to come up with something. But
And okay. That's what I love about that game.
Yeah. Both incredibly scary and incredibly rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, and now the real meat of the episode. How to make it interesting and exciting.
Yeah.
Mm.
So the first sub-point we had put down was details and descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you necessarily mean by that, Chris?
Well, I mean to flesh it out. I know we've had some rather lengthy discussions about box text before, but, you know, I think box text can really add a lot to an encounter. The Angry GM, in his article, he wrote, when you describe something, every word counts. You know, you should pay careful attention at what words exactly you're choosing. Because if you look at the difference between you walk into a 10x10 room, there's a rat, what do you do? There's a lot different between something you walk into a dank and dirty room, there's dark shadows around all of the corners, you hear a muffled squeaking sound coming towards you in the dark, something like that, what do you do? Now there's all of these different details about the room. Not only does it enhance the attention in situation, but it also gives the players more things to work with. There's shadows in the room now that they could use to hide in or to search through. The dank and the dinginess adds character to the room. The shuffling and squeaking sound will produce more varied reactions than just seeing a rat.
That's true. And I was thinking about this, you know, prior to recording the episode.
Mm-hmm.
And much like balancing an encounter to match the level of a party,
mm-hmm.
I tend to think that certain systems are more or less geared towards doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And I know giving descriptions is totally on the GM and not part of the system at all. But you look at a game like Fate or like Cortex Plus, and the things you as a GM have narrated or the details you ask the players to create very often, or not very often, can be given a mechanical weight either through making them an aspect if you're playing Fate, or by making them a scene distinction if you're playing Cortex Plus, for example. So, again, it's not to say that you couldn't do that in something like Dungeons & Dragons 4E or Pathfinder. I just think it would take more work on the part of the GM to make those details matter, because making them matter isn't really part of the system.
Yeah, I was actually going to bring up those exact examples, especially with Fate, because the characters, they can build their own parts of it by spending Fate points. They can add descriptions and details to the scene, which can only enhance it.
Right.
And, you know, it's not just throwing a lot of detail in, but it's putting more work into these details. You know, if you were, for example, inside a big warehouse full of boxes. You know, that might be interesting. It gives you lots of cover if you're going to get into a shootout or something. But imagine it to where, you know, kind of take it to the next level where all the boxes are moving around on conveyor belts, or there's some kind of robotic delivery system that's picking up boxes and moving them. I'm thinking of sci-fi, by the way.
Right, right. I kind of figured that out. I'm like, okay, yeah. Fantasy
this
warehouse, then you're like,
maybe not The Hobbit.
yep. Conveyor belts, what?
Yeah. But these things, a dynamic scene where things are moving around, it just gives more meat for the characters to chew on.
Again, we brought it up last episode, but that kind of sounds like it would lend itself to the Exalted stunting mechanic, where you as the GM, or the players, because it's a collaborative game, are putting all these details into the scene so that they can be used.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, it's just kind of flavor.
Yeah. But that said, just flavor is still something good, you know?
Yeah, I suppose, that dark and damp and moldy 10x10 foot room is a lot more interesting than a completely bare 10x10 foot room.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, one of the other things you can do to make it interesting is to introduce decision points.
Yes.
The Angry DM mentioned this in his article, and I completely agree with him. Like, the way he said it is, you should always present characters and players with meaningful decision points that actually have an effect on the outcome. Again, kind of the first place I encountered this was through the Apocalypse World games, where you as a GM are constantly supposed to ask, what do you do? You're supposed to set up the situation and then ask the player, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
And when the player answers, you're supposed to build on that answer.
Right.
But it should be something meaningful. It's not like, and you wake up in the morning, you're under the covers, light's coming through the window. What do you do?
Well, that example's not so bad, because, you know, then the whole world is open for them to do something.
True. I guess my point in that example was, there is probably only going to be one thing the player is going to have their character do.
Ah, get up.
Get up. Therefore, I was trying to set that up as a false decision point, because there's pretty much only one, air quote, correct decision.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the player could say, okay, I go back to sleep. Then the player is maybe being a little bit combative, but hey, you shouldn't have asked that such a dumb question as GM. So it could be, or again, the example that the angry DM uses in his article is, you've almost finished picking the lock, a few more seconds of work, and it's going to be open. What do you do?
Yeah.
The obvious answer is, I continue to pick the lock because you said I was almost done.
Right.
So again, it's like a non-decision point where, I mean, to use a better example, a meaningful decision point would be, you're a few seconds away from picking the lock. There's a gnoll charging down the hallway who is going to be there in a few seconds. What do you do?
Mm-hmm.
Because now there's a consequence. You continue to pick the lock and possibly get chopped in half by a gnoll, or you leave the lock alone and defend yourself, or try and do both, and do it both crappily, probably.
that would be pretty difficult, I imagine.
Right.
Yeah, I think this kind of ties into the previous one with giving lots of details and descriptions. One of the things about giving more information with the scene is that it gives the players more options to do things. With the example of the rat we said before, you go into the 10x10 room, there's a rat. There's really only one thing to do, is fight the rat.
Really? I would just close the door.
Well, sorry, maybe I'm assuming maybe you have to go through the 10-foot room to get to another 10-foot
room. Oh, okay. Like, oh, see, you've proven your point. You left out the detail that there's a door on the other side of the room. All right.
It sounds like a dungeon that I used to make when I was 14.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. If you only provide them with, here's a fight, go ahead, then really all there is to fight. There's not really anything that interesting in it besides, you know, rolling the dice and seeing what's going to happen. And of course, a lot of things can happen in combat that can be fun by themselves, but the more options you give the players, the more decisions they have to make, and decisions are fun to do. If you make a good one, you feel good about it. If you make a bad one, you agonize over it, and that raises the tension of the adventure. So you want to look at every different point you can in an encounter and try to see, what can I introduce here that can force the players to make a choice?
Right.
Or even not force, just open it up so that they have more things to do.
Then sometimes it's correct to force the players to make a choice, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Again, if you, one of the ways to ramp up tension, especially in a combat encounter, is to kind of bombard the players with choices, rapid fire choices, to kind of not give them any time to think, because that's what would be happening in real life, right? Mm-hmm. You can't take a step back and think about the best way to attack this orc because he's swinging a sword at your head right now. So right. Hurry up and make that decision. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I know what you meant. Sometimes you don't want to force the players to make a decision because it sounds like you could be railroading them or pushing them down one path over another, where you want to present them with enough options so that they feel like they're able to make their own choices. Mm-hmm. And yeah, getting back to what you said about details and the wording of how you as GM present something, you can very easily set up a combat encounter, which I keep defaulting to, so that combat is the only choice. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have the enemy just sort of appear out of nowhere, sword raised, swinging at the player character, you've kind of only given them one choice, and mm-hmm. that is to fight. I mean, they could try and back up and talk, and then you as a GM might say, really? There's a sword coming at you.
Sword,
okay,
swinging,
you open your mouth, and it is filled with 6 feet of sharp steel. Roll up a new character, please.
Yeah.
Whereas if you just describe the foes standing in a room, not really noticing the player characters, well, then you've given them a lot more options.
Absolutely.
With your red example, they could close the door quietly and move on, or they could cast that sleep spell, or, you know, charge in with fire and steel as most PCs would, because mm-hmm. they're player characters.
Yeah, and this kind of goes back to the first question, too. You know, what is the purpose of the encounter? If you're throwing it in just to have a fight, then that may be the only option there, but if you're going to do something like that, again, it's fine if you just want to drain resources or to throw a couple dice around, but keep it short, because there's a very good chance that it could become boring very quickly. Again, because it's only, all you're doing is forcing the characters to throw some dice, not to actually think about anything.
Right.
Innocence is a good way to spice up those options.
Innocence?
Yeah, just throw some innocent bystanders inside of a fight. You know, if you don't do something to help them out, they're going to be hurt by this combat around you. But at the same time, you know, you're also involved in this combat. What do you do?
Oh, that feels cheap. Here's a 10-by-10-foot room with a rat in the middle. We start to turn the door. Suddenly a maiden drops out from the ceiling.
She says, she's going to be, rats!
Yep, she's going to be savaged by the rat. What do you do?
The rat has a sword. I'm not above being cheap.
Right. But, no, and, yeah, I mean, it's not cheap. Sometimes, as you said, not sometimes, but as you said towards the beginning of the episode, this is a role-playing game, and therefore sometimes you should make decisions because it's a game. And I would also add to that and say that role-playing games attempt to emulate a certain style or genre. Mm-hmm. And therefore, sometimes, as cliched as it is, it's appropriate to have certain things happen because it's in keeping with the genre.
Oh, yeah. When you're playing D&D and you meet the boss, you fight the boss.
Right.
Because
right.
That's the genre.
I was thinking more like a horror movie, right? Mm-hmm. Of course the monster is going to pop up out of nowhere, even though you checked the room.
Right.
Or, again, of course the bad guy is going to be able to, you know, slip away despite your best laid plans, because that's just what happens. Mm-hmm. And it's appropriate for the fiction.
And good luck describing that to the characters.
Well, again, getting off a little side thing, I kind of think there's that social contract about we're playing a horror game.
Mm.
Therefore, these things are on the table to happen because that's what makes it a horror game.
Oh, yeah,
or,
completely.
You know, if we're playing heroic D&D, therefore certain things are going to happen or are not going to happen mm-hmm. because we're playing heroic D&D. Like, I'm not just going to have the bad guy get away because, well, if you guys don't plan correctly, then if he can logically get away, he will.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to, you know, cheat you and have him getting away after you cast that holding spell on him. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, that's just lame. If
I'm
your
also
GM
not about
does
being
that.
Lame.
Yep, well, if your GM does that, find a new group.
Yeah.
Or GM something yourself.
Hmm.
But, so the last one. How
rather appropriately.
Yep. Nice. How can the encounter end?
Mm-hmm.
And again, kind of like the first one, I'm going to say you don't have to answer this question.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes answering it is a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
More often, I would say come up with possibilities or likely outcomes or even possible outcomes for the encounter.
Yeah, this one, I actually want to point out that very specifically, it's not how does it end.
Right, right.
Because I feel rather strongly about this, that you shouldn't choose an end to your encounter.
Right.
Because that way you're planning things ahead. You know, the dice could go one way or the other, and your plan could be ruined, and then you've this whole big plan that you've got set up could go wrong. Again, you'll be railroading the characters if you try to force them to a preconceived ending.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And that's not interesting.
No, it's not interesting, because if you already know how the encounter is going to end, why are you playing?
Exactly.
Just write your stupid novel already.
True.
Because, hey, anybody can publish anything now, thanks to e-publishing. Mm-hmm. But, no, I think that's a really good point. A couple games of Dungeon World I ran, like, I didn't plan out the end, but I guess similar, I was using a dungeon map, a pre-generated dungeon map, and so there was essentially an end because the boss was in this final room, and so, yeah, there was kind of an end to the dungeon. Like, I knew where things were going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And certain times during the session, the players would, you know, fail a roll, which meant it was my turn as the GM to make a move.
Right.
And I would look down at my map and say, I don't know what to make because nothing could possibly happen given where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened two or three times. And after that, I just tore up the map and said, I can't do that anymore because it's affecting the game in a negative way.
Yeah.
Sort of this pre-planned kind of essentially ending is ruining the game, ruining the fun.
Mm-hmm.
So similarly, I would say, don't plan out how the encounter is going to end.
Yeah.
It's fine to plan out how you think it might end, or not even necessarily that, but possible outcomes. You know, like, again, we keep defaulting to, you know, a combat encounter, but hey, basically one of two things could happen. Players could die, or the player character could die, their foes could die.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the sort of the two likely outcomes. Then if you've answered the questions about what the point of the encounter is, if the point of the encounter is to drain their resources, well, how can it end? Again, it could end in player character or NPC death, or it could end with the player characters having the correct number of resources drained, or more or less, and then that signals the end of the encounter.
Mm-hmm. We're saying a lot of what not to do. Don't decide the ending. But the reason to ask yourself this question, then, is to consider the ending. What are the possible outcomes, as Wayne mentioned, and to come up with contingency plans for those. If the enemy runs away, then what could happen? Will they come back later on? Will they run into a better or worse situation for themselves? Or do they just disappear from the game entirely? If the players massacre them all, are there any consequences to that? Is it nothing? Does it matter at all? You know, does someone come and seek revenge?
Right.
If the players are hurt, I mean, dying, that's kind of one situation, but...
Right, what happens? Roll up new character.
Exactly. But if the players are hurt, what are the consequences of that? Will they need to go find resources to restock and heal themselves, etc.? So having these kinds of plans, then, can help you smoothly transition into the next scene.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and transitioning into the next scene is kind of the point of this question,
mm-hmm.
I think, because if the encounter is the end of a session, then you, as the GM, don't really have to prepare for as much because you can do that during the downtime before the next session.
Mm-hmm.
You can say, okay, here's what happened because of the encounter, or here's what happened in the encounter. Let's figure out during downtime what that means for the, you know, the surrounding area and the, kind of the campaign at large. And you don't have to do that while sitting at the table.
Yes. Yeah.
But if it's you know, kind of early or going to be early in the game, early in the session, and there's going to be several more encounters after this, or there could be, or there's at least more game after this, then mm-hmm. it's probably worth a little bit of your time to figure out what might happen.
Yeah, and that kind of wraps the other parts of the questions together nicely as well. You know, then you also get a better idea about what the decisions and the stakes of the people involved are, and the consequences of the encounter can help you define what the purpose of it as well. So it's a nice little package.
Right. And as you mentioned at the beginning of the episode, Chris, you don't have to do these in order. And while figuring out how it can end can help mm-hmm. you find out, you know, what's at stake and who would be involved and their motivations. Figuring out how, like, who is there and what they're involved in, that could help dictate how it could possibly end.
Yeah. And I think this question, the bigger the encounter is, the more applicable this question is. If you're looking at the final boss fight of the entire campaign, everything's been leading up to this moment, ask yourself, how can it end? Is the only way that it's going to end with the characters defeating the villain and kind of having a happy ending to it? If so, is that going to be exciting enough in and of itself, or is it, again, just going to be a bunch of dice rolling? Or are you going to make the final boss fight actually very tough, then, and it will be difficult, maybe the players will die? If they die, how do you handle wrapping up the adventure? You know, I think the bigger the fight it is, the more important this question becomes.
Right.
Because you don't want to just force your players into a foregone conclusion, even if it's the last big fight of the game.
Right. And again, we keep saying fight because it's kind of what most people think of when they hear the word encounter.
Yes. But even if it's the last big debate of the game.
Right. It could be social as well. In that case, you know, how can it end? Well, it ends with the essentially it ends with the characters getting what they want, or it ends with the characters not getting what they want, and and how do you kind of
or going into fight?
Yeah. What happens after that? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, again, we mentioned Fate and Cortex Plus, and I tend to think that the reason a lot of people think about a combat encounter when they hear the word encounter is because games like D&D and Pathfinder don't really have all that many mechanics for non-combat encounters.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas games like Fate and Cortex Plus, task resolution is the same regardless of whether you're fighting with swords or fighting with words.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's easier, or it can be easier, to see the application of these questions to non-combat encounters in those systems as opposed to systems like D&D and Pathfinder.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think D&D has gotten better over the years. It's now where if you succeed in an encounter, you defeat the enemy, then that's considered a success, and you get the experience points, regardless if you did it through combat or through...
I'm waiting to see what they say when 5e comes out. I'm not holding my breath on
we'll
that
see.
One.
Well, you know, actually, thinking about this as an example for myself, I remember it's a really memorable event, too. We, as a bunch of D&D characters, we went out and we fought a bunch of goblins, and we lost. We ran away. And the GM, he spent some time thinking about what would happen and what were the consequences of that. And the next time we met the goblins, they had gained a level in fighter because they defeated a party of PCs.
Right.
Running away is considered a feat. And then we lost again. And it got another level.
And then those goblins just became a feature of the campaign world, where it's like, oh no, it's the greenskin tribe. Run away.
Exactly.
Wow. That's pretty funny.
All right, so a quick run through the questions again that we asked ourselves is what is the purpose of an encounter? What is at stake? Who is a part of it? How to make it interesting and exciting? And the smaller points of that were adding details and descriptions and adding points of decisions and options. And lastly, how can it end, or the consequences of the encounter?
So.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idlereredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums, and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
That's not to say there's anything wrong with doing the more balanced approach. If your group enjoys doing a kind of more a fighty game aspect to it, then, you know, more power to you.
Hey, well, I'm not going to say don't play D&D 4E, but we can cut that out. I thought it'd be funnier. It just sounds like me being an ass. Like usual.
Let the hate flow through you.
Yeah. Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week, and we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.